The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hello and welcome to Spirited Conversations, a locally produced live recording of a keynote speaker. I'm Jan Marsh for Fresh FM and the Spirited Conversations Committee. Recently, our Deputy Mayor, Rowan O'Neill Stevens, led a spirited conversation at Yaza Cafe on city building, creating communities. Here's Sandy Stevens to introduce the evening.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Yaza. It's a big crowd, standing room only, and we're now turning people away. So it's the topic, it's the speaker, and it's Yaza. Well done. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce Rohan O'Neill Stevens. As most of you know, he is Deputy Mayor in Nelson, elected last year. Prior to that, he was a councillor for 3 years, and I couldn't get out of him tonight just where he's going from here, but we'll see in a couple of years' time. He's going to speak to us on city building, creating stronger communities through urban regeneration. Now, both housing and transport have been topics that Rohan's passionate about, and he's been pushing for some changes. He's quoted as saying, and he confirmed that he did say it, that he called our subpar and unaffordable housing in New Zealand a stain on the fibre of New Zealand. So he has his point of view, which we'll hear tonight. He also was one of the councillors who voted against the future development strategy for failing to change their approach to urban planning. And he instead supported increased housing density. So he'll explain a bit of that tonight. I think he's going to begin, he told me he's going to begin with dwelling in the caves. So he is going to have a bit of history. But he will explain how our urban environment shapes our lives, both positively and negatively. And with climate change and looming loneliness growing, a housing crisis and city centres struggling, Rohan will lead the discussion on how changes in our urban landscape have the potential to bring us together, create more sustainable, resilient cities, and potentially make us happier citizens. Rohan, please explain.
Kia ora koutou katoa. I'm Rohan, I'm your Deputy Mayor. And I think to start off this conversation, I want to start on a reflection on conversations in general, in that I think we often tend to start at the middle or maybe towards the end of conversations. And for this one, I want us to go right back to the start, to the principles underpinning why we're here, not just here tonight, but why we live where we live and why we do what we do. And to start that conversation, we're not just going back 100 or 200 years. We're going back 11,700 years ago to the Neolithic Revolution. Now, I'm going to first say a huge thank you for everyone for coming out. I spent the day at the local government conference, and I was busy talking about urban regeneration and the need to change our cities and the opportunities presented within stormwater and within roading. And despite being amongst a whole bunch of local government professionals and councillors and mayors, they all kind of looked at me and went, wow, you must be fun at parties. But I say that this is a clear show that I am fun at parties. Hopefully I can prove that. So 11,700 years ago, or thereabouts, we saw a significant change in the way that human societies operated. We moved from sort of hunter-gatherer type style towards agriculture. And the development of agriculture was a significant change, not just in food security, but in the way we fundamentally lived. Agriculture supported us to become denser. It saw, ultimately, the rise of the earliest cities. And what we found in there, and through agriculture, was the benefits of having shared resources and the ability to specialise. So around 9,100 years ago, in modern-day Turkey, we have what we now think we know is the oldest, or the very first, city. I'm not going to give a go at pronouncing it, but it was a city of about 10,000 people. And from what we can piece together from our archaeological findings, is there was very little hierarchy present. Houses were all very similar. Later on, some researchers think we might have started to see some of the problems that we see in our country today. Wealth accumulation, the intergenerational wealth being passed down, as well as intergenerational poverty. And we see the complexities that cities bring. But what's represented in that first city is, to me, a very fundamental question of why. Why do we live in cities? And it's a question I think everyone who lives in one should be able to answer, but it's also a question I think that most people couldn't. My answer to that is we need one another. We fundamentally require one another to succeed and thrive. When we look at the history of technological development, ultimately it all comes back to that one revolutionary, or really many revolutionary thoughts around our world, to realise the potential of agriculture, the potential of farming, not just in gathering food, not just for ourselves or for our small communities, but actually for a wider scale. And what that did was it allowed us the freedom to be able to get good at things, get really good at things, instead of all of us being dependent on how we would feed ourselves in the next few hours, the next few days. We had a security that enabled ourselves to be able to look wider and say, actually, what would make our lives better? What would make us happier and our lives more fulfilling? And this is a thread I'm going to come back to quite a bit, which is the why we all come together, why we are here today, why we live in Nelson, why Nelson exists, and why every city exists, and where maybe we've lost ourselves a little bit along that path. Now, from that very first city, we saw thousands of years of development, and I'm going to do a relatively large leap, but I'll touch on some of the highlights. Who can forget in those ancient times, the rise of Rome, that originally came out of the city-states that first formed in Greece, this idea of a political, cultural, and economic base that served not as a country, but as a city at its core. And from that, we saw the rise of Rome, and through Rome, we saw the creation of sanitation, of public housing and buildings, of ultimately the city grid that still defines the vast majority of cities today. Sparta, Athens, Thebes being some of your key city-states. And so from that point, we kind of continued on. Obviously, there were significant changes, but the premise of the city itself didn't fundamentally change from that very first one right through until the Industrial Revolution. And this is where we saw cities explode. Not literally, although actually occasionally, but in terms of population, in terms of GDP, in terms of the economic and social processes that were occurring in these committees around, in these cities around the world. And with these rise in cities and mass development, we also saw some really fundamental challenges start to arise. There's a great piece of writing from a priest living in London in the 1880s, describing the overcrowding, the complete lack of sanitation, the impacts that the mass use of coal was having on air quality, and particularly in the poorer parts of the city. And through this process, I said I wouldn't do a tangent, but a slight tangent, is who's ever been to a city where the east of the city was generally regarded as the lower income neighbourhood and the west as the richer one? Very common across Europe, very common across North America. The simple reason for that being prevailing winds. The majority of the winds blow west to east, and that meant that all of that industrialisation, all of that air quality particulates coming out of those factories was all blowing towards the east. And a lot of those scars are still present in cities to this day. And again, we see that through this history, the past is very much still with us in many, many ways. And so out of this industrial revolution and the boom, and particularly in the UK, and particularly in and around London, we saw the birth of what we'd now consider modern planning. Up until this point, you'd often see, slight forms of planning of, oh, we'll kind of put these things over here, we'll put these things over here. But no one really drew out the city as it was and mapped out, you can put housing here, you can put industrial uses here, you can put commercial uses here. And there was this really strong philosophy, and it was a philosophy rooted in the devastation and human suffering that a lot of philosophers and economists and thinkers had seen in and around London, which was, clearly there's an issue if we put our industrial uses next to our residential uses, next to our commercial uses. There's no green space here. It's a really awful place to live. So what we're going to do is we're going to completely sever these things. Many of the early designs and plans we saw out of sort of city planning as a profession were these mass visionary, in some ways, cities where you would have housing very far apart, spread in these green acres, taking up huge amounts of land, and then these centralised, often drawn as very large buildings, which would be your one-stop shop for everything in life. And it was a very natural reaction to the problem that was in front of them. It was this desire to escape the cities, escape the hardships that were there. And one of the really key things that turns those, at the time, sort of far-fetched ideas into reality was the turn of the 20th century and the invention of the automobile, of cars. And so through the 1930s and the 1970s, we started to see this thinking begin to appear in reality as we saw the growth of suburbs. We saw people moving further and further away from where they worked, from where they recreated, from where they shopped. And we see a really interesting trend, which is that urban travel speed, basically the average speed at which you get around a city, directly correlates to how spread out a city is. Faster the speeds, the further out you go, because it does not impact your ability to get around. And when we look at Nelson in particular, we see this played out, you know, perfectly in terms of also the history of colonisation in this country, of where there was, at this time in the UK, occurring this backlash. We had significant levels of poverty present and a whole bunch of people dreaming and then suddenly being pitched by the New Zealand company of this grand new world where it was all possible, where economic success was possible and where everyone could live in these perfectly designed cities. You can still, to this day, we have a very, I was looking at it just before this, very high resolution copy of the plan for Nelson drawn up in Euston Square in England. You can go through the city, and I was flying in just a few hours ago and I was kind of spotting them out. A lot of those plots of land still exist exactly as they were drawn up on the other side of the world over 150 years ago. And that lies the key to understanding where we are now, is our city was planned not in accordance to the landscape, and you can really see that when you look at the maps and then you kind of go, there's actually quite a large hill there. I'm impressed that you'll be able to cut it up so nicely. And so with then this sort of these visionary ideas and technology starting to fit and match it, and all tied up ultimately in the hopes of creating a better place, a place where we could be, again, happier, where our lives could be more fulfilling. That ultimate promise that made us come together in the first place. And we grabbed that and we said, that's where we're heading. And then in the 1970s, as we'd seen sort of the slow development of suburbs in New Zealand cities, obviously we were still quite small at the time. This development had been relatively appropriately paced. Then in the 1970s, we saw this act that is not well known enough for its impact on our history, but one that I think will become increasingly well known, which was the Town and Country Planning Act 1977. Now that really excites me, admittedly probably doesn't excite most people, but what that act did was it changed the fundamental planning regulations in this country. And we saw between 1961 and 1970 the average ratio between capacity, so not the number of houses built, but the number of houses that were legally allowed to be built, go from 3% of the population, so at any time there was capacity to accommodate an additional 3% if all of those houses were built, to less than 1%. And at the same time, what we saw was slowly at first, and then increasingly at a steeper and steeper level, house prices start to increase. At the same time as this was happening, we reached what is a fundamental problem in transport planning, which is your urban speeds cannot keep increasing forever. And so urban speeds were what enabled us to have these really wide-ranging and sprawling cities. We hit the capacity of our roads, and urban speed started to drop off, and we started to see congestion increasing. And that's kind of the story of where we are today. But I don't think that's all the story, because one of the things that we often don't discuss in this conversation is, again, that happiness question, that question of the people at the heart and who were most impacted by this decision. And so what we saw over this time period, as people moved further away from one another, unsurprisingly, people started to know less people. They were living in more isolated spots, whether that was isolated by a high fence around their property, or by its geographical isolation from where they worked and where they socialised. And so we started to see the average number of friends just start to tick down. And at the same time, we started to see loneliness tick up. More and more people feeling lonely, feeling isolated, feeling disconnected from friends. Alongside that, with our city centres, we started to see this massive boom that had led to them being really successful start to fall away as less people were inclined to hang around and stay and shop and make the most of what was there. And we started to see businesses struggle. And obviously this also went along with sort of macroeconomic trends in terms of an international trends and how the global economy was doing and how our national economy was doing. But we ultimately ended up in a situation where today 50% or thereabouts of New Zealanders report being lonely. It's where our average friends are, or the average number of people you can trust has gone from back in the 50s and 60s, 7 or 8 people, down to, on average, less than 1. We're at the point where around our country and around the world, city centres are starting to cease to exist in some ways, in that their original purpose, this original idea of a place, a meeting place. And I'll jump back to Greece for a second, because I want to acknowledge what this kind of space is. It's, in modern terminology, we call this a third space. So your first space being where you live, your second space being where you work, and your third space being where you go when you're at neither of those two places, a space that is welcoming, that's accepting, and where you can connect with other people and relax and socialise. And so we started to, back in ancient Greece, they also had this principle of the agora or agora, depending on how you want to pronounce it, the public square, where, again, a third space where people would come to connect, to debate, to have interesting conversations and ask questions of one another and engage in the politics of what was happening around them and influence decision-making that was happening for their city and for themselves as well. Because, again, ultimately, cities are made up of people. One of the reasons I love them is they are just deeply complex ecosystems with ever-moving parts. I take the sort of romantic view of cities as living creatures in their own right that expand, that contract, that output things, that input things, that produce wastes, that consume in the same way that a beehive is. And so here we are with the social issues, economic issues, and then just to chuck another one on top, obviously the output of producing and consuming mass amounts of fossil fuels and emitting huge levels of carbon is we're now in a climate crisis. We are seeing day by day hotter and hotter temperatures in the summer in Europe. Wellington is having its warmest winter on record. We're seeing these impacts, and this region knows them well, whether it be droughts and fire or floods and torrential rain. And so what do we do? And that's the fundamental question that keeps me up at night, is with this long history of progression, to find ourselves where we are, to have so much of the fundamentals quite literally set in stone around us. Where do we go from here, and how do we address these issues? We know, for example, that by 2030, that's 6.5 years away, or slightly less, we need to reduce our emissions by 43%. That sounds maybe doable, it's less than 50%, but if we actually contextualise that in terms of how much of a change it'll be, that is huge. And every day we put that off a little bit. We go, we'll get to it next year or next week or maybe 5 years down the track. And with every day that we do that, the reduction gets steeper and steeper, as we're going to have to go. Instead of, had we started 20 years ago, it would have been a nice, gentle year on year, we'll make some changes. Now, it is fundamentally going to require massive shifts in what will feel like overnight. And that does not bring me any joy, and neither does delivering that message. In our region, out of household emissions, transportation is 93% of them. Which means that if we want to achieve that 43% reduction, transport's going to be a big one of them. And this is where, in all of these challenges, lies opportunities. Because fundamentally, cities have become a place that doesn't bring as much joy as they should. They're places that emit more than they should. 75% of global emissions come from cities. But the scale of the problem is larger than that. The scale of the problem is, in New Zealand, 87% of us live in urban areas. Globally, it's 55% or 4.4 billion. By 2050, it's estimated that'll be 68% of the global population, so around 7 billion people living in urban areas. The reality is we're not getting away from cities. We're not getting away from these urban areas because the fact that brought us together still remains. We need one another. We fundamentally cannot survive on our own. One or two of us can. I know if you put me out in the wilderness for more than a week, don't expect me to come back. And even if you trained me for months, what's the life we're living? In isolation, we are weaker. We have less potential to develop and change and create new wonderful things. But together, we have a huge strength in our collective. And I think that strength in the collective is where we can start to look. Understanding our history and understanding of how we've come to be where we are, actually, a lot of the solutions begin to present themselves. The Infrastructure Commission released a report in 2022 around housing affordability. And just to be clear, our region is the third worst in terms of housing affordability in the country. With our updated stats, on average 59% of homeowners' incomes go toward paying mortgages. That is huge. For renters, again, we're one of the least affordable places. On average, that's about 26% of income going towards paying for housing. The difference there is you've not got no hope of a capital gain at the end of it. And that's and our social housing wait list has just reached 261 people, or 261 households, which is a 150% increase in the last 5 years. And so the Infrastructure Commission's report, knowing this housing crisis, knowing what we're talking about, looked at it and they said, quite simply, we don't have a demand problem, we have a supply problem. That between that crucial ratio of population to housing capacity that we saw a steep decline in the 60s, if we had intervened then and enabled more housing, particularly more housing where people want to live, housing inflation would be 69% lower today. That is a... I'll happily send you the report.
Yes, the report's bullshit.
And I think even if you disagree with the specifics of the numbers, the reality is that we are, as a country, actually quite unique, or at least the Anglosphere tends to be, at the worst end of housing affordability, and we can see clear trends throughout this. Another fun fact for you, 80% of New Zealand's housing is in quarter-acre sections. There's a reason for that, which is, again, we took our maps, we drew them up with complete disregard for actually what makes cities survive, what makes them thrive, what makes them livable. And so with that power of the collective, I actually think that there's huge amounts we can do. I mean, if we were starting from scratch, let's be clear, it would be a hell of a lot easier. We could build just sort of consistent 2 to 3 story housing, you know, relatively dense. We could have that nice gradient, as you see in cities like Barcelona that have done this, where you still maintain suburbs, but you've got a nice dense urban core and that nice graduated line out. We're not starting from scratch, obviously. We all live somewhere. And that's where the challenges come, because with change comes contention and comes very real impacts on people. And it's a really challenging conversation to navigate because, again, for me, the ultimate project at the heart of cities is that happiness, is that purpose, is that fulfillment in life. And another fun statistic, we can directly draw a line between your work and life satisfaction and the length of your commute. The longer your commute, the less happy you are. And so...
more dense your housing, the less happy you are.
I mean, we don't have statistics for that, but... and this is where it becomes very... Again, we're seeing it playing out here, is it's a very emotional response because we don't like change. We fundamentally, as humans, we like what we've got, especially if we've got something.
What are you selling, actually?
And...
wait for your questions to him.
What are you selling?
Wait till the end and ask your questions.
I think, you know, this is where it becomes really emotive. You know, I can say, like, as someone who does not own a home, as someone who regularly, I go into intermediates and even primary schools, and you ask the classrooms, how many people think you'll own a home? what do we think the hands up are? More than 50%? It's generally one or two. Like, we have created such a problem that our youngest members of our community are struggling to find hope in it. But there is hope. There absolutely is hope. And I just want to pitch you what that could look like. And when we talk about resilience, you know, it's things like actually incorporating more green space into our cities, of looking at the model of sponge cities and enabling rainwater gardens, of actually working in tandem with our natural environment. When we're looking at river flooding, instead of forcing our rivers generally into relatively straight lines, actually giving them room to grow, to spread, to be the ecosystems that they are and that we are fundamentally a part of by living near them. We don't have a choice as to whether or not our rivers will flood. They will. What we can control is how much room we give them to do that, the protections we put in place for our urban development around it. And when we talk about transport, you know, it's actually relatively simple. Provide the infrastructure for people to walk and cycle and catch public transport, and guess what? They will. It is quite literally that simple. And we have endless amounts of data from around the world, from within New Zealand, to support those sorts of initiatives. The challenge again comes back to change. And that's where I think we need to have these open and honest conversations to say, where are we heading? And I come back to a Hemingway quote from The Sun Also Rises. And a character asks, how did you go bankrupt? And another character replies, two ways, gradually and then suddenly. And I think that it's a picture that is very real for a lot of our urban centres in this country, is we have been going broke gradually, and I don't think we want to hit the suddenly. And when we talk about from a council lens, one of the big challenges we have is, and what everyone will hate, is a rates rise. One of the issues is that we've built cities that fundamentally cannot financially sustain themselves. For every kilometre we go outwards, for every further sprawl into the suburbs, our infrastructure costs increase at a higher rate than our rating base does. And what that means is that existing residents have to continue to pay to subsidise for this further and further sprawl. And we know that this is becoming a very real problem. Nelson's actually done all right. There are places in Aotearoa where you look at the financials and you go, I don't know how, as a city, it can financially survive without massive intervention.
Firing out to council staff.
All right, I'll get to that. And we also talk about civic investment, of when we start to see our city centres declining. Actually, one of the core reasons for that is because we're not giving people enough reason to want to spend time in these places. One of the things we know that we can do, and where we've seen really successful urban regeneration, is by investing, is by making places that people want to be, by investing particularly in those third spaces, those spaces that people can go and just exist. Whether they be libraries, whether they be town squares, whether they be a playground, exactly. They are all things that bring people in. And again, I think what we have lost so often in this conversation is people. Because cars don't shop, bikes don't shop, e-scooters don't shop, people shop. People spend time, people engage with one another. And if we can't centre our lives around making people enjoy their existence here, if we can't put people at the heart of what we do, then again I come back to that question, why do we do it? Why do we choose to live in cities? Because now it is increasingly more a choice. We can buy rural property, we can head out, provided we've got the means. There will always be many that do not have that choice. Now again, on that positive of what cities can and I'll be really clear, in my view, what they should be are places that people can easily get around, where accessibility is high, where we have invested in things like canopy protection to protect from when, again, inevitably, we start seeing further severe heat waves, where having large areas of concreted land is only going to worsen our problem. We need to start looking not just at hoping for future technology to come, but actually grasping what we've got in front of us and making the most of that to transform our cities. And yes, it will mean, and I know there's some energy in the room around it, it will mean more housing, and it will mean greater intensification. And that is a conversation that we obviously have to navigate carefully, because we don't want to displace and destroy people's well-being. We want to uplift everyone. But the sad reality is that we cannot uplift people solely through building outwards, further onto floodplains, further onto productive land, further onto further costs for those already living in our city centres and in our city. We just can't continue with the model we've got, so we need to have the conversation about what another one looks like, about what that change looks like, and about how we navigate that change. And it needs to be a proactive one. It needs to be a positive one of going out and saying, actually, what could these changes look like? Because we don't have a choice. We really don't. When we talk about those statistics, when we talk in particularly in Nelson's case of an aging population, there's nothing wrong with that. But the problem you get is if you haven't supplied any housing that young people can afford to live in, you're actually not going to have the cafes, the restaurants, the stores that make a city worth engaging in. And so, you know, I do still have immense hope, because I actually think that Nelson's very lucky. Ironically, and again, we'll thank the Romans, the city grid is a wonderful invention. I can talk at length about, you know, Jane Jacobs' theories around the number of intersections directly correlating with the number of interactions you'll have in a given day, of the traffic volumes directly correlating to how many of your your neighbours that you know. You know, there is a large body of evidence here that we should be engaging in, that we should be conversing about. You know, we formed cities, again, because we needed one another. And I think that there is a thread that seems to believe that that's no longer the case, that we no longer need one another. And I do disagree. You know, I think me standing up here today was only possible thanks to those council staff members that made sure that the roads from the airport to my house were built, that the water that came out of the tap that I'm now going to hydrate with is clean and functioning, that our wonderful Yaza staff are here to feed and open this place and provide it for us. And I guess my challenge to you all would be, even if it's just an hour of your day tomorrow, just clock how much you rely on other people, and therefore how needed this conversation is about how we can support and uplift our whole community and build a resilient and ultimately happier city, because we have to stay focused on that goal of why we're here. Because if that isn't the goal, then I don't know what is. Kia ora koutou katoa.
That was Rowan O'Neill Stevens, recorded live at a spirited conversation at Yaza Cafe in Nelson during July. Spirited Conversations air Friday afternoon at 3. Podcasts of this and previous episodes can also be found at freshfm.net and the accessmedia.nz app. Just look for Spirited Conversations. I'm Jan Marsh. Thanks for joining us for Spirited Conversations at Fresh FM.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. visit our website freshfm.net for our contact details.